critics watch most of the movies they review in comfortable, intimate screening rooms. That means they see each other quite a lot, and sometimes they even speak to each other. Judging from their reviews, they disagree on whether what they've seen is good or bad as often as they agree. We have decided to force three of the best to talk about what they do today. Georgia Brown is here. She's a reviewer for the Village Voice. Dave Kerr works for the Daily News, and Armand White for City Sun. I'm very pleased to welcome them all to New York & Company. Hello.
Hello.
Dave, Georgia and Armand work for Weekly, so they have lighter workloads and longer lead times. Do you envy them that luxury?
I envy their...
You guys can disagree later, as I expect you will.
I envy their ability to choose sometimes, sure. I think the challenge and a lot of the hassle of being a daily critic is you have to see really every movie that comes out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can get a little mind-bending.
And you only have to write three paragraphs on it.
A little longer than that, but yeah, that's true. A lot shorter than a weekly review. Mm-hmm.
But still, you would prefer to be able to say, I don't want to see this thing because I'm going to just pick two films to review this week, like Georgia and Armand do?
I guess I try to keep up with everything that comes out. I was doing that even when I was a weekly critic. But, the workload is just trying to chunk out 500 words about a movie that you really just didn't care anything about. And that's when it gets
in fact, you would have left if you hadn't been forced to see it all through because you were reviewing it.
Sometimes. I really never walk out of movies, though. I always kind of want to know how it turns out.
Armand, in your case, you don't even have a lot of other reviewers at the City Sun to worry about, so you can pick whatever you review, can't you?
No, movies are they're my playground, so I take all the films there. I have other people writing. I'm the arts editor at the City Sun as well, so I have other people writing on music and dance and theater, mm-hmm. though I sometimes go in those areas too, but I keep movies as my own little kingdom.
Uh-huh. So if we see you reviewing certain films, it's because those are the ones you chose to review.
Well, absolutely. I guess choice is a luxury, though I don't think of it as a luxury. I think of it as a necessity. Why waste the public's time with movies that you know better than to write about?
In your case, Georgia, you are the number two at the
That's
Village
right.
Voice. Jim
yes.
Hoberman gets first dibs at whatever movies he wants to see.
That's true, except Jim is now reviewing for a premiere, so that he allows me to review some of the movies that he reviews at premiere.
I see.
So I do get to do some.
But was that frustrating in the old days? A movie that you really wanted to talk about, you couldn't because somebody else had first preference?
Oh, sure. Sometimes I would rather talk about the movie that he might be talking about, but that's the way it goes. And I think that we both are in the position of not having movies that we want to talk about, that the movies these days don't offer that much. And I think this year, for instance, we've talked about revivals a great deal because some of the best movies have been revivals. Like I just did a small piece on Kaspar Hauser, and I think Jim this week did Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, it's a new print, and in a way, it's like a new way of seeing a movie that we thought we knew. Kaspar Hauser is a movie that didn't get a lot of attention the first time around, so people are seeing it in a new context, don't you think? But still, what you're saying is that there aren't a lot of good movies these days, although it's my feeling that movies have always gone through these trends of good periods and bad periods.
Well, you know, one of the luxuries, I guess choice is a luxury that I do allow myself, is in choosing the films that I think are important. There are a lot of revivals, and I certainly do believe in revivals and support revival theaters, in fact. But sometimes I think revivals are just another example of film industry hype. Some revivals don't necessarily interest me. Sometimes I think as critics we're compelled to respond to things to revived films that ordinarily we wouldn't respond to. Sometimes I guess for an example, I would pay more attention to some new releases, probably give more attention to a new release than I would to Kaspar Hauser. Only because I would take issue with you. Kaspar Hauser got very much attention in 1975 when it opened. It's just that
not from me.
It's just that's 20 years ago, so it seems dead to a lot of people today, I guess.
Well, the three of you bring a strong sense of film history to your reviews, but in your case, Armand, you want that to be something that just is referred to in the review of something more contemporary, the others would prefer to also talk about the old films because you enjoy them more?
No, I insist that my readership have an active sense of film history, that they go to new movies remembering the old ones, because that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most important things you can do as a critic, is to bring in a sense of history.
But Dave, writing for the Daily News, you can't always cite obscure cinematic precedents.
No, you
can't. I suspect
an
editor will say, what is this? Who is this guy, this director from the 30s you keep on talking about in this review?
Just no, you certainly can't overdo that, but I think just trying to slip in a little bit of background information and give people a context to see the films in.
On the other hand, The Village Voice, if you don't stick in as many obscure references as possible, the editor says, Georgia, what's going on here? No?
Well, not the editor, but I would say the readership probably.
They're going to send you a letter saying she didn't even realize that that film was really a remake of something done in 1907.
Right, and I there are lots of times when I don't realize things that my readers do realize.
Uh-huh. Well, I imagine all of you go through that, don't you?
Sure, but you know, this is the way of keeping film culture alive. I believe in pushing your readership to know more, and if necessary, pushing your editor to know more, to allow you to say more. Otherwise, you know, you're just a tout sheet.
Well, in your case, you're your own editor, but in other cases, there's always this war that I hear goes on between the reviewers and their editors. Well, editors have one sense of what the reader is all about, and reviewers who have a sense of what their job is all about.
I probably have the same relation with my publisher that these guys do with their editors. But in all our cases, I think we have to push for what we believe in.
Oh, well, I don't think, maybe I gave the wrong impression about the relationship with the editor at The Voice, because I think the film editor is very much on our side and, you know, likes what we're doing and obviously took the job because that's what she realized.
Does she have to be a film buff too?
Well, I think if she wasn't before, she has to be now. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think she's trying very, that she is becoming a film buff.
Well, Dave, I've spoken to a critic who used to work at the Daily News a number of times, Kathleen Carroll, and she talks about the frustration she had in wanting to write certain kinds of reviews and then being reminded that she was working for a mass daily.
Well, of course you are, and I think you don't want to condescend to your audience. You do want to treat them with respect. The kind of mail that I get from Daily News readers, I'm sure, compares with the kind of mail that comes from Voice readers. People catch me in little mistakes of film history. People are recommending films to me that I don't know. I mean, there's a very active community out there reading the Daily News as well as these other publications.
Do you try to make it a point to see the films that you know you're not going to review just because you want to know what's going on?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's important to keep up. Though, after a few years' experience at this, you can smell a bad one coming.
Now, you smell what the way you are informed that a film is coming is you get a little press release from the publicity company that's handling this film, and they will tell you that this is the best movie ever made by a first-time director starring three obscure stars. And you might say, ooh, this doesn't sound too interesting. And then the film comes out and everybody says, this is the best film by a first-time director starring three obscure people. and you feel like an idiot because you didn't go to see that one. Instead, you went to the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, which was just terrible.
Not necessarily. You have to know who you're reading, whether it's reading a publicist announcement or whether it's reading a colleague. You have to know who knows what they're talking about and who's just selling the latest product.
Oh, yeah. And there's a tremendous grapevine. We all show up at the screening room a few minutes early and just sit around and compare what's coming up, what we've heard. But
how can you trust those people? When I read the critics sometimes on a film that I've seen, I'll ask myself, did we see the same movie? And then I'll read three different reviews from three of you, for example, and wonder whether you three saw the same movie. You all bring a strong sense of cinematic history to these films and intelligence, and yet you see very different films.
Well, sure. We're all different people with different sets of experiences.
So this really just comes down to taste, finally?
I hope so, yeah.
Sure.
If there were a right or a wrong about this, there'd only be one film critic in New York, and I don't think it would be me.
Well, I guess it does come down to taste.
I mean, Janet Maslin would just have the job for everybody?
Presumably, sure.
Well, you know, it does come down to taste, and some people have it, some don't. Some have bad taste, in fact. It's true. Yeah, you know
well,
that.
Well, we'll all agree that there are certain things that just aren't good. But then when we get to the next level, there are people who like La Dolce Vita more than they like La Ventura. There are people who like any one film more than another. Sometimes I can't understand it because I think it was just... Recently, Jim Hopeman gave a negative review to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, a film that I think is just one of the most wonderful films I've ever seen in my life. So What does that mean? I suspect it means that Jim Hopeman has a certain idea of what a movie should be, and sometimes I agree with that idea in certain kinds of films and disagree on others.
Well, that's certainly what it means, but of course there are differences between people, different perceptions that people have. So I have a kind of, I guess, ornery position where I think that there are some things in the world that are so, and I think this applies to art. There are some things that simply are good, and if you don't recognize it, then you're an idiot. And if you don't recognize it and say so, then there's some worse kind of orneriness going on with you. In the case of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, that's a particularly strange case because that's a unique and bizarre film. If someone doesn't get it, I understand why they don't get that one. But there are other films where I am unforgiving if people don't appreciate it.
Well, that's led to some of the politics of film criticism, hasn't it? Where at least one critic for years would call people in other cities and say, how could you have gotten it so wrong? I thought you were a good critic.
Oh, we wonder you remember who you're talking about.
Tell us remember her? She used to write criticism at a certain major publication. But she really insisted that people share her vision. And
well,
I suspect that she was doing
what
a lot of people do in their own minds.
Well, obviously, from listening to Armin talk, you can tell Armin expects people to share his vision also, and I do too. I mean, I think that's the glory of movies, is that it touches you so deeply and so much inside of you that you're defending yourself in a way, and that there comes out that, you know, sort of right to exist, and that your sensibility is yourself, and that makes for a lot of the tenor of movie criticism at its best, I think.
Go ahead, Dave.
One of the things
you're allowed it's your turn.
Most about this work is when someone comes up to me and says, how could you...
You like that the most?
Well, how could you hate This is my favorite movie? How could you dislike it? You know, it means so much to me, and obviously it does, and I feel like I've inadvertently insulted someone, which I certainly never mean to do.
The Daily News for a while, or the Sunday News, used to publish letters from people saying, how could Jim Farber think that this rock group is awful when they're my favorite group? And I would wonder why any newspaper would publish that sort of thing, because what all this really came down to was one person's taste versus another person's taste. And isn't that what much of this comes down to?
I'm very sensitive to other people's feelings about movies. I mean, and I really hate it when I find out how much someone loves a movie and I hate it. And I'm very, I will actually sort of waffle. I think for the same reason I hate to meet directors or actors or anybody like that. I want to keep that out of my life.
When it becomes personal, it becomes very difficult.
Because I don't, it's very hard as a critic, I find.
That's why you didn't review your son's film, Kicking and Screaming.
Well, and I also said that at the same time that his movie came out, I couldn't help seeing every movie I was reviewing as my son's film.
Let's take a little break and find out whether you, when we come back, whether you're just expressing your opinions or trying to convince people to share your opinions. We'll also talk about some other aspects of this work and take some listener calls at 212-267-WNYC. My guests are New York & Company, Dave Kerr, who writes for the Daily News, Georgia Brown, who writes for the Village Voice, and Armin White, who writes for the City Sun. His volume of criticism called The Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World, is published by Overlook Press. We're back talking about film criticism with three of New York's finest. Georgia Brown, who writes for The Village Voice, Dave Kerr for The Daily News, Armin White for The City Sun. And they all have their followings. There are some others out there who have loyal followings. We have a couple of nice reviewers in the... Well, one really good reviewer in The Observer, Andy Saris. The New York Times has a couple of good reviewers. They all have their audiences. But I wonder what you think your role finally is. Is it to educate? Is it to just express the opinions of somebody who is knowledgeable about films? Or is it to convince people to see one and not to see another? Let's begin with you, Georgia.
Well, I have often thought that that one of the foremost things I am thinking about always is myself as consumer guide, because I know that before I became a reviewer, and I actually haven't reviewed that long, maybe 6 years, that I used to read The Voice because I felt that was the one publication where I could find out what I needed to know in New York at that time. And you, certain kinds of people need a guide that they can say this is, and someone, a reviewer that they can trust. And
but a consumer guide based on what? The Consumer Guide magazine, they do these scientific studies and they find out whether this soap works better than that. You bring a film background to your job?
I bring a background as a film buff or cineast. I never studied film. I went to school before they had anything like film studies.
Before they had movies, Georgia.
Well,
but I
just joking, just joking.
That The Voice itself, has through Jonas Mekas and Andrew Saris, had developed a tradition of a certain kind of criticism. Mm-hmm. And then Jim Hoberman came along, and that's where we got our news. And I felt that's where, I've always felt that's where I belonged, and I was lucky to get there.
You also see yourself as a consumer guide, Armin?
Well, Georgia said news, and that's the word that I relate to. I come out of what I think of as the journalistic tradition, where a writer has to provide the readership with some information. And I think of myself as doing that. But while I'm providing information about a film that's available to see, I also do want to educate them about the context in which that film appears in art history, as well as basically just make sense of that film to myself. That's mm-hmm. that's the work I'm doing.
Yeah,
and
it's often a way
hopefully
of
that will inform
yourself.
Others. Pardon me?
It's often a way of talking to yourself and finding out what you think while you're writing.
Yeah.
Well, right.
There is a commercial side to all of this, and there's been a lot of talk about pressures at some publications. What if you see a movie that you know will be a blockbuster that you don't particularly care for, that your editor happens to like as well? How do you deal with something like that? Do you become the lone voice against something that
Well, I think you have to express
a lot
your
of
opinion,
money?
Definitely. But with that sort of big Hollywood movie, there's almost always something to write about. You know, why is this working the way it is? What is this saying about where we are in 1996?
Mm-hmm. But that's a think piece. Can you do a think piece in a daily review?
Every piece
well,
should be a think
hopes.
Piece to some
yeah,
degree.
Yeah, I think we're all trying to do something more than the plot, and did we like it, did we not? And mm-hmm.
Well, it's often been the case that the big Hollywood films have gotten the bad reviews and made many, many millions of dollars.
Oh, right. Sure.
So is what you're doing irrelevant, at least in that regard?
Yes. Oh,
no.
Absolutely.
Well, absolutely
no,
not.
You hated Pulp Fiction. It did very nicely. I don't think that you held back that tide.
I don't care about that. I care much about informing those few lone intelligent souls out there who have some sensitivities that movie offended, and those people need to be backed up.
I totally agree with that, but I meant that it has no influence on how a movie's going to do or mm-hmm. what the studio's going to put into it, or which really has most to do with how a movie does is how much the studio puts into it.
How much television advertising there is.
Okay.
Well, I've
critics very little to do with that.
And I never see your names on the blurbs, or rarely see your names on
right.
the blurbs. That's because you would feel sullied or in some way used in the wrong way.
Yeah,
if they
the critics you see in the
Brown,
blurbs.
Dave Kerr loves.
Those are critics who call publicists and give them quotes. Uh-huh. That's the way it works, and we don't do that.
In fact, true critics are irrelevant to that practice. In fact, they don't need us. They find they find their own publicists all over the place. They don't actually have to read reviewers to get quotes from anymore.
No, a good way of judging the quality of a film is just read who they're quoting in those ads. And if you've never heard of any of the outlets, then I think you should think twice about it.
The newspapers, even the New York Times Weekly, reveal how much a movie has made, as though that were some kind of a consumer guide. Does that upset you now?
Yes, that's a new trend.
That's just the last 10 years or so. And Premier Magazine,
I think it's even less,
that,
like maybe 5 years.
That cult.
Yeah, now we have, the Times used to list the top-selling albums and things of that sort, but now they have, right above the top-selling bonds and mutual funds and a whole bunch of other stock things, they have movies. And the same thing that the Daily News runs, in fact.
It's a service that syndicates that.
And sure. It tells you how many theater seats were filled and how many theaters were showing the film, how many screens. Mm-hmm.
That's a bad turn of events, isn't it? And it's part of a legacy from the greedy 80s, where people care more about how much money an industry is making, care more about that than they care about aesthetics. You know, there was a time where, you know, long before the New York Times started printing the weekend grosses, they used to, at least on the Sunday's editions, run counter reviews or counter essays in the arts and leisure section. That was a way of furthering film culture and encouraging thought about film. But now journalism is in lockstep with the industry and advertising its movies and helping the industry make more money. Critics have to stand against that tide, I think.
Okay, put on your headphones and we'll take some calls. A lot of people are calling in. My guests on New York & Company are Georgia Brown, Dave Kerr, and Armin White. We're talking about film criticism. This is AMA 20 WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Cece from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Cece.
I just want you to know I'm enjoying your discussion very much. First of all, I just want to ask a twofold question. I want to know what your distinguished panel of critics think about my favorite director, I think the world's greatest director, Robert Bresson. To me, he's the Rembrandt of directors. And also, I have two films that I particularly like very much, and I wouldn't say they were the greatest films ever made. They weren't anything extraordinary about them, just the acting, but they were done so well. And I wonder, if you ever had that feeling about a film, you liked it very much, but yet you can't say it's a great film.
What are the two films?
Well, actually, one is the last film Truffaut made called Confidentially Yours, beautiful black and white. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Black Friday with Stanley Ridges, Boris Karloff, and Bela Lugosi. Beautiful film about greed, like a Dr. Jekyll and Hyde, Mr. Takeoff. Jekyll and Hyde Takeoff.
I'm sure we all have our versions of those kinds of movies in our heads. Well, what about Bresson? Can we say that any director is the greatest director that ever lived, as great as Robert Bresson is?
I'm always reluctant to do that because there are so many directors I love, but certainly Bresson is one of those people in a category just so much unto himself. He invented his own way of making movies, and he's a unique figure.
Also amazing that he got to make so many movies, considering how little the money the movies made, how great they are, but how little they actually brought in at the box office.
Well, they were all commercial films at the time. We forget just how commercial the French cinema actually is. In his later years, he got a lot of subsidies from the French Ministry of Culture and such like. Mm-hmm. But his great films are all made for commercial producers and got commercial distribution.
Well, Bresson is one of those figures who I sort of alluded to earlier as one of the absolutes. You wouldn't take seriously any person, certainly not any critic, who would say that a Bresson film was worthless or no good.
But could there be let's say the last five Bresson films you've seen were just wonderful in your estimation, and this one is just awful.
Well, they're not.
Do you question yourself, or do you wonder why you just thought this was so bad, or why you were so bored?
Oh, I think everyone makes major and minor films, and even the minor films have something to say about the person who made them.
Mm. I'm so glad that Armin, in this case, won't think that I'm nothing, because I do agree with him.
Well, okay. Well, we all agree that Robert Bresson is a great filmmaker, maybe not the greatest that ever lived. What about that other question? We all have favorites that aren't that we know aren't great films, but that we have a special fondness for.
Well, it's movie culture, and it's good to be fond of films. You don't have to defend them before a panel, before a jury. It's okay to like them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Not every film is perfect anyway.
No.
And then there are some perfect ones that you realize are perfect but you don't like as much.
Well, you know, I never use that phrase, guilty pleasures. If you have a pleasure, mm-hmm. defend it.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't agree more. That's
okay.
Well, I'll even agree with that.
Okay, hey, this is the first time these three people have agreed on anything. Thank you, Cece, under those circumstances. Mel from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Lenny.
Yes.
The UPS guy just rang the door, but wait a minute, I'll take care of this anyhow.
Well, let me put you on hold, and I'll go to another call, and then I'll come back to you. Take care of the UPS. Dean from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm not much of a moviegoer, but I must say that I do kind of depend on what Armand White writes in terms of his reviews. He's got that take-no-prisoners approach, which I like.
You know? Now, what does that mean for you, Dean? Does that mean that if he says, I really love this film, you're going to go run out and see it?
Absolutely.
And if he says, I hate this film, and that means you're not going to go see it?
I'm not going to go see it.
Now, have you ever been in a situation where somebody said to you, let's go see this movie, and you know Armand gave it a lousy review, and you went reluctantly because your buddies were going? And
no,
you liked
I
it?
Have no. That's not a situation that's come up.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I say I'm not much of a moviegoer, so it's easy for me to say I don't think I want to really be bothered. But there is in the current issue of A City Sun, Armand has reviewed. Armand, I'm talking to you now.
Okay.
You reviewed the A Family Thing.
Right.
But I couldn't quite get where you were where you stood on this film. What exactly were you saying about this film?
Well, I stood at some distance from it, actually. In its effort to make sense of American history and how history is alive in the lives that people live every day, the way it played out, the connections that need to be made between the races, I thought was a good thing. I thought the movie had very, very, perhaps overly sentimental moments. But most of all, it was beautifully acted, especially by Robert Duvall. And the actors helped to explain some of the complications of race relationships that I haven't seen worked out in most other movies, actually, and that was something. It wasn't a movie that I could look at and tell you, well, that was a great film, because I didn't think it was, but it had things of substance and value in it.
The other two, either of you review Family Thing?
Yeah, sure.
What did you do?
I imagine the film was produced because it reminded somebody of Driving Miss Daisy, and it is a far better movie than that.
Yeah.
Still within the limits that Armand was mentioning. It's a bit contrived, a bit sentimental, but has, you know, a lot of good aspects to it, certainly.
Is there something wrong with something being sentimental?
I like a lot of sentimental films, at least films that produce powerful emotions, but I always feel they should be earned more than cued by the music or by a sudden close-up or...
Like Lola. Is,
reaction shots
Jacques
of people Demi's crying.
Film Lola is sentimental.
Well, all of
Demi. But, boy, I love it.
Sure.
Okay, let's go back to Mel from Brooklyn. Hi, Mel.
Well, what I have to talk about is...
UPS man is gone now.
Well, yeah. My question really is this. I mean, I don't want to talk about my favorite movies and have my opinions validated, but I'm very...
Who cares anyway?
That's true, beside me. I'd like to ask a question that's maybe sociologically based, and that is, I'm confused by a new genre of movie that's like... You mentioned Pulp Fiction earlier and like Fargo, with two-dimensional characters... Well, essentially, it's a new genre of comedy that I don't remember ever seeing before, where people are laughing at two-dimensional characters brutalizing other people. I saw Fargo the other night, where they're putting chopped-up limbs into a wood chopping machine, and then on the news that night, heard about the body parts being dropped into the Passaic River, and my daughter saw it with me. And when she saw the movie, she just thought it's a movie. But when she heard the news report, she was flabbergasted that a thing that's given as a devastating crime on the news is portrayed sort of in a humorous way in a movie. So I guess my question is, what is it in the context of modern society that allows that enables the comedy to take that form?
You want to respond?
Well, that's a good question. And that certainly is something.
Anybody here like Fargo?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
I did not.
And David?
No, me neither.
And I had mixed feelings about it. So,
well, absurdist comedy is nothing new.
Yeah.
And one of the purposes or functions of absurdist comedy is to get you to understand, accept, or to keep your own balance in a world that's gone crazy. I think that's part of what's happening in Fargo, as well as I think there is some genuine affection for American foible, for regional eccentricity in Fargo. Though I will also say that it goes over the line here and there, but that's because no one's perfect.
Now, there was another call coming in about Fargo, but the guy hung up. He was going to ask about the 2 stars that you gave to Fargo, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't believe that you could rate it so low. But the star system has to be a big problem for you, doesn't it? There are movies that you can feel ambivalence about, think it's
definitely
good and bad,
no,
and you still have to come up with some kind of a star.
Very happy
to
live without that. Absolutely.
But you can't. And this is not just the Daily News. The Newsday also has stars, and the New York Times has it not in films, but they have it in restaurant reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Detroit, and there's a paper there where the critic uses rosebuds.
Would you be happier with 10 stars or something like that so you can get, or like the wine things where they have a rating system from 100 down?
Right. I'd be happier with none at all, but I think,
half.
Yeah, it's a way of kind of catching the eye of the reader who is not going to read you, and to that degree, I guess it's useful.
But I don't know what 2 stars mean. 2 stars usually means, I would think, a reasonably okay film, and then I read a really negative review. I think, gee, that should have gotten 1 star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it covers a lot of ground. In the case of Fargo, I think, you know, technically, it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking. Probably the best cinematographer working today, Roger Deakins, who was a genius. Beautifully lit, beautifully framed, you know, every inch of it, and just the work of totally soulless, you know, cruel people.
I thought it was the best film ever made by the Coen brothers, and I don't know whether that is praise or not. We thank you for your call. Jane from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Well, I myself take great critics with a grain of salt. I read Armand White's review of Clockers, took the movie, and several other reviews of the movie, took the movie out, and the movie had absolutely, in my mind, nothing to do with any of the reviews that I read.
Now, you took it out, you mean, as a videotape?
I took it out as a video. I, by the way, come from a family that's been involved with showbiz for many generations, since the 19th century. The movie industry, particularly on the business side, movies are a business. They why people feel defensively about that, I don't know, except that I perceive there's a lot of politics that get played at what movies, how movies are reviewed, but it is a business.
Well, Jane, what are you saying about Armand's review of Clockers?
I
he liked it, right?
I felt that the movie...
No.
He didn't like it.
...a very valid point about the pressures brought to bear on a young man. The movie was not about Harvey Keitel, which was, you know, he made this whole thing about Harvey Keitel, but Harvey Keitel was more of a apparatus of the movie rather than a main character of the movie. He moved the plot forward, but it was the young man in the movie who was actually the main character, his life, his pressures. That's not the only movie. I took out Rangoon, what is it, the movie about Burma.
And
Beyond Rangoon. Which I think got bad reviews because of the politics of the movie.
Patricia Arquette, right?
And I thought
John
it was
Borman.
John Borman.
Movie.
Beautifully directed film.
So what are we running into here? One person likes a film, one person doesn't like a film, or... Or something else going on?
Well, that certainly was part of what's happening. I would say to this caller, though, one thing I try to do in my review of Clockers was to give you some idea of what the ideology behind Clockers was saying to the viewer. I think movies are business, but they're art too. Movies are also politics. And
Spike Lee is very conscious of the politics in his films, isn't he?
Sure he is, and I think viewers should also be conscious of the politics in every movie. Just because the young teenage character in Clockers had more screen time doesn't say that Harvey Keitel's character was not important to it. Harvey Keitel did more than push the plot. He was representative, of course, of authority in that movie.
But it was based on a book where the white cop even has more of a presence than he does in the film.
So basically the point of what I wrote about Clockers was that the Harvey Keitel figure was in fact important despite his screen time, and I wanted readers to pay attention to that and to think about what that character meant in terms of the movie, to read through Harvey Keitel the politics in the film.
Which was not
just follow the plot.
Which was, as far as you're concerned,
pretty complicated to...
Spike Lee's politics and not your politics.
No, we all have different politics, but though we have some common meeting ground.
Is he better on Sex Phones?
Oh, that's a worse film, of course. He was better on Do the Right Thing. Probably his next film would be good. It sounds like a good subject, actually.
You others want to, anybody want to join in here, or you don't care?
Well, I don't. I didn't read Armand's review of Clockers, so I'm not sure.
What about seeing films on videotape? I'm sure you have to at times because you just can't see all the movies you want to see. Filmmakers hate it when you see them on videotape.
Never for review, certainly.
Mm-hmm. You don't. You try to see it on a real screen with an audience.
The way it's meant to be seen, yes.
An audience
you're
is
not
optional.
Seeing, yeah, well, you're not seeing it with a typical audience anyway. You're usually seeing it with a bunch of critics or people in the film business.
I always wonder who those people are, actually. They're not critics. I know them.
Well, you're talking about
the screening room crowd. And
Rex Reed had a phrase. He called them cousins of publicists.
Mm-hmm. Probably. I always thought that they were the gaffer's cousins.
Right.
Also.
The secretaries who work in the office and their families.
Let's take one more call. Frank from New Jersey, you're on New York Company.
Hi. I was wanted to ask an opinion on business about Quentin Tarantino, that it's sort of a rising list of things that he has supposedly lifted almost intact. I mean, there's a business of the whole subplot in Pulp Fiction with the girl overdosing is from some obscure documentary called American Boy. There's a Hong Kong film called City on Fire that Reservoir Dogs takes about 25% almost directly from. Even things like, there's a quote from Ezekiel in the movie that is misquoted because he took it from a Sonny Chiba movie where they also misquoted the Bible. And I just wonder whether...
This is nothing new. Sergio Leone stole a Kurosawa film and then later had to give credit. He stole it almost frame for frame, except that he had Clint Eastwood instead of Toshiro Mifune.
Right, well, I mean, and there's also...
desecration in itself.
Which was itself stolen from Red Harvest, the Dashiell Hammett novel, so it goes back further than that.
Right, Kurosawa took it. Mm-hmm. And there's also business that Roger Avery supposedly not just gave a story, but wrote about a third of the script and was paid off to take his name off the screenplay.
So what is this all about? Quentin Tarantino is a real creep. Is that what you're trying to say?
Does a critic feel, I mean, first, whether they have any opinion over this, is whether this is legal or ethical plagiarism, and whether they feel any responsibility when they hear things like that.
Is this your responsibility in reviewing a film, or is this a separate article?
There's no way we can know about that stuff, really. We can recognize sources and influences and hopefully point them out, but we're not there to...
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you recognize something that you've seen before.
Definitely, sure.
Well, you know, there's that phrase that a good steal is an homage. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Yeah. I think it's something that you can beat Tarantino with if you want to beat him with. And
he's very vulnerable right now, isn't he?
Because obviously he is a big borrower, but I don't think that anyone would say that that's not legitimate in mm-hmm. making films.
He's not only a borrower, he's a lender, isn't he?
He certainly makes it into his own thing.
A lot of people are imitating him, so he's neither borrower nor a lender B. It doesn't apply here.
Well, it's nothing new, but I guess he is the reigning cannibal. I just happen to think he's bad news, although I liked Reservoir Dogs, but I think he's bad news. In particular, the critical response to him has been bad news, has sounded a death knell, and I think... In a critical response to movies,
but isn't he also under attack from everyone?
Well, he ought to be. He ought to be. I mean, he's a big buff. He's a great buff, and in fact, that's something that I like in him. But I think critics have not actually been critical enough with him. Have not been rigorous enough with him. They've simply responded to the buff in Tarantino, which I guess is to respond to the buff in yourself, without asking him to account for politics, to account for serious art.
But they didn't hold Steven Spielberg to that standard, and he was a buff who borrowed from everything that was before him.
I'm sorry to say that I think the critical fraternity just slanders Spielberg every chance they get. They never look at him seriously either. They simply dismiss him. Except in the case of his last film.
Who are you talking
about? Someone you need to reckon with every time.
Well, I certainly think so, but I think he has not been reckoned with.
Georgia, you're in the sorority. It's okay. Let's take one more call. Adam from Westchester, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah. Hi. I'm not crazy about this business of film reviewing. I think...
Wait. Adam, before you go on, what would you offer as an alternative? Films come out.
Okay, here's
what would you want to do? What would you want
to happen? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I have a problem with reviews that from start to finish trash a film. For example, The Village Voice, the New York Times makes or breaks an independent film. and I'm not an independent filmmaker with an axe to grind, but I live up in Westchester, and I read it to know what to come downtown to see. I rely on the Village Voice for the same thing, and I don't like when reviewers make themselves the stars of their reviews and just kind of cavalierly trash a film because they don't like it. I mean, maybe the problem is audiences take film reviews too seriously.
Okay, well, let's talk about this for a second, because independent filmmakers often complain that they probably need a bit more support. They are in a more vulnerable situation. A Hollywood film with millions and millions of dollars behind it can withstand a negative review, but something that is aiming high, misses on some levels, should be treated a bit more cavalierly. What do you think?
Well, I don't think any of us thinks that we're being cavalier, and I'm not sure what reviews the gentleman is talking about, but I think that we all, if we're, I wouldn't even use the word trash, but if we really respond negatively to a movie, that's our responsibility to convey that. I would don't like it.
You don't even care whether this represents something, perhaps.
But I do think that every reviewer I know is certainly takes into consideration the fact that this is an independent film, or that it's a first film, or whatever. I mean, that goes into your consideration of a film.
That the director may have had to make some compromises because of budgetary constraints, or couldn't get the best actors, and so this might have been better. The next film might be better with more money and a better cast.
Oh, none of that ever matters. What matters is whether the film's any good or not. Everybody who makes a film, who does anything, has to deal with compromises and setbacks, and you do your best. What you judge is the final product. You don't know what's behind the final product. You judge it. I think critics deal with all movies fairly. I think what independent filmmakers ought to be worried about is the placement of reviews. For instance, when a critic, I guess, for editorial reasons, has to give more space to the big Hollywood product rather than an independent film. The problem isn't necessarily the particular response or review of a movie, but how it's placed on the page.
It's a question of accessibility, too. If most of your readers don't have access to the Angelika Film Center, you can't really lead your section with that review.
I want to thank you all for being on New York & Company today. We've run out of time, but my guests have been Dave Kerr, Armin White, and Georgia Brown. We've been comparing notes and sometimes even agreeing on what's going on in the film business. Thank you so much.